I would argue that if we were any good at what we've been doing these last couple of years, 5-6 years from now, everybody will want to spend at least 2 years at a place like CMS.
This is Dan Diamond, and you're listening to Pulse Check. Andy Slavitt is one of the most prominent people in healthcare. And as the guy in charge of CMS, he's also one of the busiest. MACRA, the biggest change to how doctors get paid in a generation, was just finalized on Friday. Obamacare exchanges, they're opening for business in 2 weeks. Drug payment reform, it's ongoing. It is all landing on Andy's desk. And on this podcast, you'll hear him rattle off his to-do list. Now, we've already had Andy on Pulse Check. He was our debut guest. I'd encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. But we kept getting requests to have him back, and I thought it would be an interesting comparison. What does he know now that he didn't know 6 months ago? Just a word to listeners. I caught Andy at the end of a very long day. He'd been in 2 time zones. He'd made a stop with President Obama at the White House. I was keeping him from his dinner. So we're grateful that he carved out some time to talk with us again, and we'll get to him in a moment. But first, a heads up. Several great guests are coming up in the next few weeks. The Surgeon General, Harvard's Bob Lendon, one of the most important figures in public polling. And I'd love to get your feedback and suggestions on who else we should be booking. You can find me on Twitter or by email at ddiamond@politico.com. You can send general suggestions to pulsecheck@politico.com too. And don't forget to rate us and review us on iTunes and other apps. That always helps us move up the charts and find new listeners too. And with that, here is Andy Slavitt.
Let me check some coffee.
I was going to ask what your secret was, because you started today at, what, 4 a.m.?
Mm-hmm.
4 a.m. Eastern or 4 a.m. Central?
4 a.m. Central.
I read somewhere, maybe this was in like the Time magazine piece, that you are better at getting by on less sleep than anybody.
I think it's all a matter of the work you're doing. I mean, if I were doing boring work, I probably could sleep all I wanted and I wouldn't be doing as good a job. But if I'm doing great work, I can find the energy somehow, at least so far.
What about podcast conversations? If it's a boring conversation, are you going to fall asleep halfway through?
No, I'm not going to fall asleep. I've got my coffee and I'm talking about one of my favorite topics, which is healthcare.
So yeah.
It'll be good.
One of your favorite, your go-to topic. So every week I ask listeners for suggestions of who they want to hear on the podcast. The most requested guest, which is kind of odd, is you, because you're already on the podcast. You're on the debut episode.
People don't know enough people.
Well, I think they know plenty of people, but your name keeps coming up. It does make me, there has been lots of talk lately about vote rigging, which makes me wonder. But a few things have happened to you since the last time we spoke for this podcast. There has been some rulemaking. There have been some political fights. You were named Modern Healthcare's 10th most influential person in healthcare.
Yeah, I'm still bitter about that.
Because you thought you should have been higher?
Because who are these 9 people?
Well, two of them are, one is your boss, and then I think she was 5th, and your boss's boss, President Obama, is 1st, so.
Okay, good. So you make a good point. These are good people.
Do you feel like the 10th most influential person in healthcare?
No, I think, I don't know what that means. I think I feel like I've got a great job to do for at least 95 more days. It's a privilege to do the job. I think it's actually the less visible, quote unquote, influential moments that are the best moments. I'm going out tomorrow into the field to a facility that has kind of innovated how they work with people with disabilities. Next week I'll be in Oregon.
Wait, where are you going tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're going to be up to New York, in Brooklyn.
Montefiore or?
No, it's a facility called Independent. It's independent living facility. That's a part of the Duals program. It's managed Medicaid agency. Next week I'll be in Oregon, looking at rural health facilities that are a part of kind of a new wave of their new kind of collaborative Medicaid program. They're trying to figure out how to innovate. How to change where people live with people's health. And so extremely excited. The governor and I are going to go see that face to face. So those are the moments that are pretty electric.
There are so many moments that we could talk about and so many things that you're working on. I think where I want to start is with MACRA, the giant physician payment rule, landed on Friday, the goal of moving doctors toward value and away from volume. Where do you think, Andy, MACRA ranks in terms of all of the things that are influencing healthcare this year as an event, as a regulation? Where does MACRA sit?
So, I think MACRA is instrumental for a number of ways. First of all, I have to start with the fact that there are a lot of incredibly serious people in the Congress that have been thinking about and working on how to get past SDR for years.
This is the sustainable growth rate formula, the doc fix that bumped down the...
Yeah. Republicans, Democrats, people we interact with all the time. And, from their perspective, they accomplished something, I think, rare and enormous. Rare, probably, in this political climate, but enormous from the standpoint that they put in place a lot of things that I think they can be hopeful about can make the next 50 years of Medicare go better. Now, they did something that I'm sure feels scary to them, which is they handed it off to the administration and said, these are all the things we've worked on. And what's fortunately, I think both the president and Secretary Burwell have really been working as part of our own I would say legacy, but the things that I think we really feel like we need to leave the healthcare system with are the tools to kind of work better. So in some ways, just to start with, if for no other reason than the way we worked with Congress, it's been an enormously positive experience. I haven't been in Washington that long, Dan, but it's as ideal of a Washington bipartisan kind of experience as you can imagine, which doesn't mean there haven't been disagreements, but it's meant we've been in constant contact with the committee chairs, with the key people who are interested in this, with the doc caucus, working through issues, giving them feedback. And I think when they saw that our interest in MACRA was beyond just finalizing a regulation that they began, but was getting the policy right. And I think the way they saw this was they saw us go out into the field. They saw us talk to thousands and thousands of people, bring back data, share information with
doctors.
Them. Yeah, over 100,000 people attended our sessions, over 4,000 comments. I went out and sat in physician practices and small offices, and we had really astounding experiences, and it completely changed how we wrote this, and it completely changed what we did, and it completely changed how this got done because we took this approach, which you and I have talked about, this approach where we let the users of the policy help drive the results.
User-driven policy design.
You don't even have to make air quotes anymore, Dan. It's becoming a thing.
Well, especially in this room, I'm sure it has been said more than once.
I think it has a hashtag.
It based on your office's Twitter savvy, I wouldn't be surprised. So we talked in March, the day that your agency proposed the rule, and I want to play back something that you said at the time.
In the process of trying to put a lot of good ideas in place, really lost the hearts and minds of physicians who practice medicine every day. Hmm. They feel over-regulated. They feel like we are requiring them to use technology that isn't working for them. And then we are measuring them in a really through a patchwork of methods.
So that was a younger Andy Slavitt. But I want to cue on that hearts and minds idea. Do you feel like with the final rule, you've won back doctors' hearts and minds?
Also, I think it's a path. I think it's a road. I don't think anything like that happens in an instant. But I'll tell you what we did. We had I think there is a sort of a general thesis in healthcare quality that if you measure and measure and measure to the nth degree, you will somehow be improving people's performance, either the signals you're sending or the quality improvement work and so forth. There's large bodies of work on that. But, we've had 5 years of experiments through the Innovation Center where we've learned how people learn, how people change their practices. And going out in the field, there's actually a counter thesis, which we developed, which is a little more simplistic, but it goes something like this. What if you gave physicians back 30 minutes in their day to see patients? And what if on top of that, you made physicians feel not measured and watched, but respected and supported.
What a radical idea to give physicians back time and make them feel valued.
Right. And would you take the bet that with that time, good things are going to happen for patients? And that is absolutely the bet that we think leads us on the right path. And the more time we spent in the field, the more time we spent talking to physicians, the more we figured out the nuances around that, the more we figured out the diversity of the types of practices that were out there and where people were, and the fact that we needed an approach that allowed people to start from where they're starting and begin a process that will build a better, more durable Medicare.
So I don't want to get too weedy, but weedy enough. I mean, we're having a conversation that policy wonks are going to be listening to. What do you think is the single most transformative part of MACRA toward getting at that goal of giving doctors back more time, helping them feel more valued?
Well, let me tell you a story, Dan. When I went out to San Francisco, and I was out there to meet with different practices and get input into MACRA. And one of the places I went to was San Francisco General, which is this great
public hospital
teaching facility. And I sat around a conference table with dozens and dozens of people, and I think there were people who ringed the table at the wall, and there were people who introduced themselves, and they had, I think there were three people who had the title, you know, quality analyst, quality improvement analyst, and so forth. You know, later that day, I drove over to the Bay and was in Oakland, and I met with a mom and pop physician's office. I think it was literally a husband and wife, although I'm not sure. And it was just the two of them. And we know from the data that practice in Oakland or across the Bay can deliver just as high quality care as you can get in a bigger setting. In fact, that it has to be the case that we work in the system that way. So, look, if all of us got access to the best that our healthcare system had to offer, we would be doing pretty well. But the reality is our healthcare system leaves a lot of people behind. And it doesn't leave people behind because we are making explicit choices. It leaves people behind because we're making choices that work for some of the people, but not for everyone. So the importance of getting out in the field is that the most important things we can do is say, look, there are a set of people that have really effectively been population health managers for years. There are a set of people that have effectively been doing integrated care and proper follow-up care for years. Our job for those people is to support them, make sure they get paid more for doing the right things, make sure they feel like they're in a system where they get paid to do what they're already doing. But there's a whole other set of people that are all over America where we have lots and lots of people who get care, and their equation looks a little bit different. And so I recognize that we can't have a one-size-fits-all, and I recognize that that meant a much more complex way of thinking about our jobs and ultimately offering up a much simpler, gettable solution.
So if I can paraphrase a little of what I've heard, MACRA, the entirety of it, is getting to some of the biggest challenges. It's hard to pluck out a single most impactful strategy or change in your mind that gets physicians from volume to value.
Well, again, there is a we you know, because we live in a multi-local healthcare system, because we have different structures, integrated, independent, et cetera, I mean, What we know works is if we have independent primary care physicians that have the time and have the tools and get paid to spend more time with you and your family and take care of you, you will stay out of the hospital more. When you're in the hospital more, you're less likely to come back for things that you shouldn't be back in. If we allow the system to consolidate and integrate, a couple things tend to happen. Prices tend to go up. And also, you tend to use the real estate that you've built. That's just the way the healthcare works as a business. So investing in primary care, investing in the things that create essentially more capability in the places and more resources in the places where people aren't getting it is really the great task or the great trick. I mean, if you want to talk about what we've learned in the Innovation Center, that's another story, and that's kind of part of what you're asking, which is what of the models that are out there are working, and there are a number of lessons there. The problem is I can't take even the best lesson that we have from how to do cardiac surgery and sweep it across America in 1 year.
I want to talk about the Innovation Center, but let's stick on macro for just a little bit longer at least. The number of comments that you got, you alluded to this, Andy, 4,000 comments. The amount of scrutiny over this regulation has been borne out by a pretty positive reaction. Congress seems happy. Most associations have been pleased. What do you think was the most significant change from the proposed rule to the final rule that helped win support?
Well, I think evidence that we listened and evidence that once you listen, you can't help but act on the things that matter. So what were the things that we heard and that we listened to that were important? First, I think people really wanted to see that we had respect for the diversity of practices that are out there. That, in the words that I've used since we've launched this, we're not trying to make everything happen in 2017 and transform Medicare in 2017, but we're trying to get a path, and that path may be different for others. I think that was helpful, number one. Number two, that we recognized that small practices who perform high-quality care have a reporting burden, and until we get to a place where that becomes more and more push button, putting more burden on smaller practices doesn't make sense. So interestingly enough, Dan, we can cover 93% of Medicare payments and still have only something like 60 to 70% of physicians have to participate, because there's a lot of physicians that just don't see a lot of Medicare patients, or they may be physical therapists and they may see a lot, but they don't get paid very much. So asking them to add that burden doesn't make sense. Third is, I think, giving people opportunities to form models locally that are physician-driven, things that we refer to as advanced APMs, but are really this sort of organic way that people are finding of developing things at work and getting that pushed along and moved through. People wanted to see that was going to be a achievable process for them. A lot of flexibility. And then I think finally, the fact that what we rolled out actually wasn't so much a health policy, but it was a way of interacting that really spoke a little bit more to the 360-degree nature of what people need to do to see patients. So if we really want to give people that 30 minutes back, we have to find the places to take it from. So we launched this with a major initiative that we have to reduce burden and with some immediate reductions in medical review. We launched this with technology that was really designed by physicians that they can use and interact with, that has some really exciting things coming that will in the next releases that are going to be very cool. And we designed it. Well, you're going to just have to see the next releases, but they're really going to make things fit and connect better together and give physicians a one-stop shop. And we're gonna also have to challenge the vendor community for so long. And by the vendor community, I'm specifically talking about the EHR community, who for so long has, I think, kind of ridden on a post-High-Tech Act wave. They're now going to have to start over and really start to add the kind of value to the physician practices and to patients that they need.
Of all the things that might have been dropped for the final rule, what's the one thing that you were sad to give up? Understanding that the proposed rule always comes out with some trade-offs, the understanding that the rule is proposed, groups take aim, some things go away.
Yeah. I mean, so I would say, you know, and what you're describing probably is right in a normal world. But I think if if the narrative is CMS does X, groups, Washington associations say they don't like X, CMS changes. That's really not what happened here. What happened here was we really went out to get an understanding for ourselves. And the way the proposed rule worked in this case was it says, okay, we've got to build a consensus over an approach based upon an RFI that we've done, based on a lot of interviewing we've done, based on a lot of things that we've heard and done and talked about with Congress. This is where we're starting. And then it gave us a framework to go out and solicit feedback and aggressively solicit feedback. So I would say the 4,000 comments and the 100,000 participants in our meetings were far more important to us, quite frankly, than any particular bit of pressure that we got in Washington.
So MACRA is the story right now, and the final rule was just released. The next big story is open enrollment. We are 2 weeks out before the exchanges launch, which I have to imagine is an especially fraught time for any CMS administrator, but especially one who came to this seat because of the failure of healthcare.gov. What is your top concern right now, Andy, for this upcoming open enrollment?
It's definitely outreach, and that's the focus. You know, here's the way I look at the challenge. Right, we have by the latest report, something like an 8.6% uninsured rate, and I recall
lowest rate in history.
And for those of us who've been in this in healthcare for a long time, you know, it was a number that never budged. And now we're used to seeing it budge. In fact, I remember saying to the secretary at one point, "I would love to leave this administration. I would love for us to give the president a single digit uninsured rate." And that just felt like this is what we owe to this president who went out and did such a brave, bold move in making this agenda move forward.
And now the uninsured rate has been single digits for over a year, I think.
Right.
The challenge is, does coverage necessarily equal access?
Sure.
Is it good coverage?
Sure, of course. Absolutely. It's a step in the road from coverage to care. And we can talk about that, too, because we spent a lot of time thinking about that. But so we think about, okay, who is the rest of that 8.6%? Some portion of those folks, unfortunately, are people that are ineligible for coverage because they're not
undocumented.
Undocumented, right.
Yep.
That's actually a fair bit of that group. Then the rest of the folks are in three categories. The first are the working poor. And if they are blessed to have won the lottery and be in a state where they've expanded Medicaid, they're covered. If they're not, then in those living in those locations, then they're not covered. So, you know, job one, which is going to be job one going forward, I think, is to continue to work with states that want to go forward and find this sort of a common sense approach.
I'm not sure folks listening to this podcast realize just how much of a differentiator the poverty status is when it comes to being uninsured. I think if you're poor or near poor, the uninsured rate is 25% or higher. Whereas for the rest of us, it's something like 6 or 7%.
Right. That sounds right. And the spillover effects are enormous. For states that have expanded Medicaid, there's all kinds of great studies about what it's done for the state budgets, what it's done for the hospital sector, but also what it's done for the marketplace. Rates are 7% lower in areas where Medicaid's been expanded. So that's one segment. The second segment of people are the people that we're about to really address right now, and that's the chronically uninsured. And these are pockets of people, immigrant populations. Some are young people. They're people who are in sort of different sectors. And we're getting smarter and smarter about who those people are. And what's, I think, we're most excited about and most enthusiastic about, and we've been talking about publicly, is, you know, we've got some strategic approaches that we're really eager to see make work to hit that group. But we've got to make dents in that group every year. We're not going to get, if there's 6 or 7 million people in that group, we're not going to get them all at once, but we're going to get, you know, some at a time.
And this is like the millennials, which you're doing outreach to
right.
This year.
Yeah, that's one segment of it, right?
Yeah.
And then the third area is our people that I think there's a expression for it that's something like the new economy. But these are people who are really want to be entrepreneurs, or they would rather be contractors, or they have they want to do that temporarily. They just don't want to be glued to a job just for benefits. And what people forget, and it's probably the least talked about story, is the marketplace is for them too. The president and the leaders in Congress, when they were talking about the Affordable Care Act and putting this together, part of the rationale is to make sure that our economy cannot be so tied to this job lock idea. And these are people that will come and go. Some will come in for a few months. Some will come in for a year. Some will come in for a year and a half. And, you know, the up and down that I think you see in the marketplace actually is a very healthy thing from their perspective. And some of those folks will come in and open enrollment as well.
So just repeating those groups back, we have the undocumented immigrants who unfortunately can't do much about. Donald Trump can. He'll lower the uninsured rate by deporting them. But then the poor, chronically uninsured, and then the new economy. I don't know if listeners can hear the police cars coming because I made a bad Donald Trump joke. But the concerns that you listed off around outreach, certainly a big priority for the administration. One of the biggest concerns I hear, Andy, is around rates, around affordability. You just flew in this morning from Minnesota. Your governor, Mark Dayton, said last week, the reality is that the Affordable Care Act is no longer affordable. In Minnesota, rates are going up on the Obamacare market 50% to 67%. Insurers are dropping out. Is Mark Dayton, is your governor wrong?
I love Governor Dayton. I don't think he's got that exactly right. I think here's what we know. Rates are going up in 2017 to a greater extent than they did in 2015 and 2016. So why are they going up? The largest reason is that rates were largely speaking underpriced in the first couple years of the marketplace. So before you start thinking about risk pools and young people and this and that, remember, we've never covered sick people before in this country, no questions asked. I don't think we knew how much it would cost. And even in 2015, and the early parts of 2016, people weren't quite sure what the data was saying. And then, of course, recall that with the Supreme Court decision, Medicaid changed. There were some other changes that were made in Congress. So there's been some unevenness. So I think this is a year when I think people are seeing rates move up. Now, are they moving up too high? That's the next question. So two things. My two answers to that question. One is right now, we are about 18% below where the CBO estimated rates would be. So kind of in a more perfect world where we had better data, rates would have started 10% higher. Rates would have gone up a little bit more in 15. They would have gone up a little bit more in 16. And we'd have a smooth landing here. No, that would be better, but we don't. The second question, though, is that remembering that you can only charge in premiums effectively some multiple of what your claims costs are because of these medical loss ratio rules. The real question that I think has got to begin to be asked is, why is healthcare not affordable enough for everybody to be able to afford it? And that's a question that we've had to ask before the Affordable Care Act. I think the Affordable Care Act made some of these things visible, but certainly didn't cause them. So there, and again, you get to a lot of the things we talked about earlier with MACRA. You get to parts of the country where there's less competition, like rural America, which have gotten affordability challenges. You get to prescription drugs, which are I think have been in the news as affordability challenges. So the right dialogue certainly is about how to help people make sure that they have affordable premiums. And I would say that the good news is the law contemplated a lot of that because of the MLR caps, because of the tax credits available to 85% of the people. So even as rates go up and adjust, people are going to be able to find affordable plans by and large. But then I think we also have to really have the serious conversation in this country about what does healthcare cost and how do we deal with that?
Well, one solution that's been bandied about a bit in Minnesota, and your boss's boss, President Obama, has floated this too, the idea of a public option. that a government-run alternative plan could be useful in some of these states. Where do you sit? Is that a good idea for states that might need more competition?
So I think that has to be part of the dialogue. And I think there are probably, and I, you know, I think what the president wrote on this topic is, you know, there are probably a few different ways to get there. And I think that's the fair dialogue is, you know, I think the first question is, can the marketplace on its own, and I don't mean marketplace, health insurance marketplace, but can the market on its own provide enough competition and choice? If it can't, then you look at something like what we have in Medicare, where a large segment of the people are in what we call Medicare Advantage, which is private sector, and another large sector that people are in Medicare fee-for-service. So there are models that can work. There's also models where Medicaid or Medicare can be moved and adjusted to cover more people. We made a big change by having people who are 25 and under able to be covered on their parents' policies. So, you know, these are not these aren't mysteries. I think there's lots and lots of options if the private sector market isn't able to do the full job.
Let me just double back on that. Have you talked with states at all about the public option yet?
So I think some states have submitted different kinds of waivers or queries or so forth, but there's nothing significant that I don't think you know about that we've had in terms of conversations, or at least not that I'm aware of.
I'll have to check my own reporting.
Okay.
You mentioned the Medicare, CMMI, yeah. The Medicare Innovation Center, which has become a little bit of a political target in recent months. Some Republicans have said it's not delivering on the potential value of the $10 billion down payment in the center. It's the center that creates the accountable care organizations. Why do you think CMMI is becoming a target at this point?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I think where Congress has an important point to be made is, look, you don't, the purpose of the Innovation Center isn't to supersede what we do in our work in making statute, right? And that is completely correct. And I think to the extent that that there is a concern, I think we get that, and I think that's completely right. I think the other side of it is that that the one thing that we are always asked for is to make sure that we are nimble and responsive when there are things in the healthcare system that aren't working for people. So if there's too much burden, or if people in rural communities can't innovate in certain ways, or if there's a new device that someone wants covered, people will say, well, CMS, you should be more responsive. You know, you should be able to solve that problem. And virtually all of those problems our ability to be responsive are really what the Innovation Center allows us to do.
Right. The idea that you can scale up very quickly pilot into something that could go national.
And so if you go back to the earlier question around MACRA, if our ability to deliver lower burden, our ability to deliver more models for people so that they can dream up ideas, send them into us, and say, hey, I've got a better way of taking care of this cardiac patient or this urology patient.
That's why you think you need the Innovation Center.
The Innovation Center is critical to that. And I think, without putting words in anybody's mouth, I think the people across the spectrum see that and believe in that value. I think they just want to make sure that it isn't crossing lines it shouldn't, and I think that's very fair.
So one of those big pilots, one of those big projects, is this idea of drug payment reform, the Part B demo, which at one point seemed like it was coming this summer. Now it's middle of October. The final regulation hasn't hit yet. Is this going to be coming before Election Day?
You know, I think the one thing we hopefully demonstrated with MACRA, and hopefully at least since I've been here overall, is that we listen and we seek we take input, and you know, we are not here to create things that are not responsive to what people see and feel. So when we came out with that particular proposal, you know, we made, first of all, it was done with a lot of consultation, a lot more consultation than I think people publicly give us credit for. And here again, we put forward a proposal to get reaction to, and we got a lot of different reaction. I think among the kind of things we heard, too large, make sure that there are no patient access issues. And I think our first obligation is always going to be to make sure the patients get what they need. So, you know, a very good set of feedback for us to process. And I think when we go to the point where we finalize, I think we want to be in the same place we are with macro, where we've shown people we've really listened. And yes, we sometimes need to test things, but we need to test them on a scale that that people feel good about and that protective of consumers and so forth. So there's a set of complicated issues, and I'm not going to run up against the clock just to shove something out.
So, but this is coming. You haven't given up yet.
No, I think we're absolutely working through a lot of the issues and a lot of the extensive issues that we have. But we're not. And I think sort of extracting from that for a second, the thing we can't give up on, or it would be a shame to give up on, would be the whole conversation about the cost of medicine in general. This isn't the one effort at taking on the cost of medicine, but we do have a situation which is untenable for many, many Americans right now, whether they're on Medicaid, whether they're paying part of their premiums or coinsurance in Medicare, whether they're in the marketplace, wherever they are. We have a situation that is very, very difficult for people. And so it's only going to get more difficult unless we take it head on. And I think there's very good news here if we choose to grab onto it, which is that we've shown with hospitals and physicians that if we work together, there are a set of solutions that can help move us forward. And we talk very frequently with life sciences companies, pharmaceutical companies, many of which have very promising innovations. Of course, there are others that don't have promising innovations. They have generic drugs or other things that they're moving the price up on. That's another matter. But if you ask them, do you believe that there is a system where you can continue to innovate, continue to have R&D, go after some of the big things? Today was Cancer Moonshot proposal that we handed the president today. They will tell you, yes, there absolutely is. But it takes people getting around the table and working on it. It's not going to be effective if we go to our traditional corners, as we do here sometimes in Washington, and say, let's just kill things, or let's heavily promote an agenda which doesn't move things forward.
We've talked about physician payment, which, in my opinion, that might end up being the signature effort of the Slava tenure here. The drug price reform effort the drug payment reform is still ongoing, but something that you said is coming. What's the issue that, just for lack of time, there are 95 days left in your expected time here. What's right. The issue that you're not going to be able to get to that you wish it could?
So it's funny thing. When I look at my to-do, I keep a to-do list in ink on paper. I don't know if a lot of people do that anymore. But
I've got mine right here. I've accomplished like very little of this though.
You're today. A reporter, so that's good, and I'm glad you do. But on my to-do list is EpiPen, Zika funding, Flint, opioids, primary care payments, several Medicaid waivers, the cancer moonshot. My to-do list is full of Puerto Rico. Which is a very difficult environment right now, as you know, for Medicaid.
Sure. But a lot of those to-dos are to-dids, right? Like Zika funding came through. Is EpiPen, do you feel like that's been appropriately resolved?
Well, for example, for Zika, we have funding, but now we have to make sure it gets to the right places, the right people. So we've got to stand up a program to work with the states and figure out how to allocate the funds and make that work here within the agency. So... these are these are things that we have to make sure we're working collaboratively with CDC. And I've got a biweekly call with people in Puerto Rico around the situation there that relates not just to Zika, but also relates to some of the other pending financial issues. So all the things on the list are things that are big issues that I feel obliged to have, at the very least, a solution. I'd like to have a kind of a solution set in place. I'd like to have career staff, working and running on them. And look, there's going to be five or six more that come up between now and the end of the term, and we're going to take those on too.
What do you think those might be, sitting here in middle of October?
Yeah, I think they'll be just like this. They'll be like, like the situation in Flint, Michigan, like the situation with Zika. There'll be things we don't anticipate. We built the bandwidth here. And I will tell you, go back to something you said about healthcare.gov and Macron, and maybe you think about the span of those 2 years. 2 years ago, the suggestion was that people did not have a lot of confidence in this agency to get big complicated things done and executed for the American public. Now, I came in and I joined partly because I didn't want that to be the case, and because I knew that the people that was not the destiny of the agency. And so you can go out now 2 years later, and in many respects, I would agree with you, MACRA was as big a launch in many respects as was healthcare.gov. But it was, I think the message should be clear. There will be big, complex, challenging things that are going to need to get done in healthcare. We want Congress to feel incredibly comfortable with our ability to execute, our ability to deliver, our ability to collaborate, our ability to listen, and move those pieces into place.
Thinking about what's coming, and I want to kind of close on this and maybe move on to a lightning round if we have time. Lots of Americans are watching this election. They're watching the debates, and many of us, maybe I'm extrapolating a little bit and projecting, a little exhausted by this election. And for many people, there's an abstract connection to what they're seeing. It will affect them. They just don't have that direct role in their life. You, on the other hand, when watching these debates, you're watching a person who will potentially pick your successor. What is your emotion watching debates, watching this election right now?
Well, that's look, we're all human. We all have a sense of feeling like there's a lot of questions being asked, things in the balance. But we all want what's best for this country. And I'm
do we?
I'm a true blue optimist in the sense that I believe that come January 21st, the people in this agency, no matter what, they're going to do their jobs exactly the same way. They're going to get the jobs done exactly the same way. They have to. We have to. And so I think that we need to have an agenda here, and that the team will need to have an agenda here that will obviously mesh with whatever political leadership comes into the department, to the agency, into the White House, and so on and so forth.
Your agenda is building on Obamacare, and the Republican candidate wants to roll back Obamacare on day one.
You know what? I actually came into this job, maybe because of where I came from, not viewing healthcare through a political lens, and I'm sure there are plenty to do, and maybe I'm wrong, but I came from and still live and spend my time when I'm not here during the week, in the Midwest, and I'm spending a lot of time around the country in different parts of the country, where there is a political policy component to healthcare system, but that is such a marginal component of what affects people's lives and what affects the practice of medicine and what affects things. So I'm going to continue to have blinders with that regard. And I think that's the healthy thing to do.
flipping this around, Wednesday night's debate, I think this podcast will probably air ahead of it, there's going to be a section on entitlements where the candidates will be asked, presumably.
Is this going to compete against the debate?
I think lots of people will pick this podcast over the debate. We're going to put them up simultaneously. If there's a question about Medicare or Medicaid for the candidates, what do you, as the person who knows about as much about these programs as anybody, what do you think that question should be?
So the thing that I think we have to think about with these programs is that we all own them. And I think about that, and I've thought about that a lot lately with MACRA, and I think a lot about that when I talk to a state or a governor about Medicaid, is, you know, the people in Congress are have a strong sense of ownership because they're entrusted to do this and are entrusted with the taxpayer money. We, of course, do as well. But when you get out into the field and talk to physicians, and you get out and talk to patients, and you listen to people who talk about the day their mother turned 65 and they became got onto Medicare, and what an incredible day that was for many people. And Medicare enjoys something like an 87% satisfaction level. And people completely misunderstand Medicaid as well. You know, Medicaid, as I think you know, a large portion of Medicaid goes to take care of people who live with disabilities, people who could be us if something happens.
They got a bad break.
Yeah, they get a bad break. And so just having a consciousness and understanding that these programs are there for us, that we have to steward them, that we have to steward them for the next generation, that we have to get the kind of experiences out of them for people that we want ourselves. I'm not answering, I'm dodging your Wednesday question because it's really not my domain. But, you know, I think that having people who really appreciate that and care about these programs and don't just view them as line items, but really care about what they do is going to serve the country well.
Let's move to the lightning round and wrap this up. So quick answers from relatively rapid fire questions. Last time we spoke for this podcast, you said as a recommendation to your successor, this job needed to be not a stepping stone, it needed to be the last job. Is this your last job?
I think it needs to be the job that people, it can't be a stepping stone. So I'd say this isn't a stepping stone. I think, you know, when I leave, whatever I do will be a step down. I can tell you that because there's no way I can imagine doing something that has nearly this much impact and it's this important and that the stakes are as high.
You've talked about missing your family and going back to Minnesota. What are you most looking forward to doing in Minnesota? Isn't there some burger like the Lucy?
Juicy Lucy.
Juicy Lucy.
Yeah. I spent all of Sunday watching football with my 14-year-old. And texting with my 18-year-old who's now at college and, you know, not really looking for hours at a time at my iPhone or my iPad. And that was, you know, I think there'll be a long, I could do that. I can absorb that for the next few years because I think that's the fleeting time.
Are the Minnesota Timberwolves going to be in the playoffs this year?
I just listened to, my son sent me a podcast which said that they are the Timberwolves are the hipster team.
I listened to that podcast. Is that the Ringer podcast?
Yeah, the hipster team.
We are actually competing not just against the debate, but the Ringer basketball podcast. That's our number one competitor.
Yeah, I listened to that, and I think we're going to do better.
It should be a good year.
No, I mean, this podcast is going to
do better. You've given me so many juicy things, like the Juicy Lucy. The most underrated member of Ake Shake Chess.
The most underrated member of HHS.
I should note there are two people sitting in this room besides us. You're welcome to name one of them or someone else.
Well, it's funny. I think the way I choose to answer that question is when people in generally, you know, get a piece of mail from CMS or hear the word CMS, The brand just historically hasn't been that great. But when people meet somebody from CMS, whether it's Kate Goodrich or Jean Moody Williams or Patrick Conway or Tim Groninger or anybody else, instantly people say, wow, you've got fantastic people. So I've been trying, and this is sort of the social media trick here, is to put some names and faces on this agency so people don't just think about CMS in this sort of monolithic fashion. So I think the people here tend to get underrated for that reason. And I think particularly the people in the regions, because the people in the regions are dealing with cases and patients and physician offices and hospitals every day. So making it okay for their personalities to emerge is, I think, a great opportunity.
More annoying to argue with, a House representative whose name you know or a Twitter troll whose name you don't?
You know, I've been told it's a mistake to argue with either.
Sometimes there's a little bit of overlap where a House representative can take your Twitter argument and put out a press release, hypothetically last week.
I have no comment.
If someone wanted to start a career in healthcare right now, and I think this will be my last question, where should she begin?
So, number one, I think get experience close to the patient. Close to patient care. I don't think you have a basis or a grounding that's worth very much unless you have some experience like that, whether it's in a clinic, but in some way you've got to find that. And then I think there are so many places to take that. I would argue that if we were any good at what we've been doing these last couple of years, 5-6 years from now, everybody will want to spend at least 2 years at a place like CMS.
The Andy Slavitt path.
Well, I think the things you get to see and get to touch, and we have to change our model from only civil servants who spend, you know, decades here to rotating through people here who want to spend some portion of their career, and then they'll just know a lot more. And I think that's the culture of this place and the ability to attract talent here. Will make an enormous difference. And I see it happening. I really do.
Well, thank you for letting us get yet another peek within the inner sanctum of CMS after hours on a very long day for you. Thanks again, Andy.
Thanks, Dan.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thanks to our producer, Matt Subasinski. Our lone producer. Normally we have like 4 people to thank, but thank you, Matt, for stepping in and helping out. Pulse Check's available on iTunes, on Overcast, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, other podcast apps. It should be there. Please let me know if you can't find it on your favorite one. And we'll be back again with a new episode of Pulse Check next week.